ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Afternoon, I'm Selena Green and this is the South Australian Country Hour. Great to have you on board. In just a sec, some good news for one of South Australia's key grain roads. It's been dubbed the worst, but hopefully it won't be for much longer. And have you ever done a complete pivot when it comes to what you farm? You'll meet one farmer who's chucked in cropping to focus solely on sheep.
The returns on our cropping in the last 20 years have been at break even, probably in a lot of those years and below. So the average over the long term is sort of, you know, we're doing a lot of work for not much return. So it was a decision made mainly on economics.
Maybe you've done something similar. Did it work out for you? What was the biggest lesson you learned? My talkback number today, 1300 222 891, or that text line is 0467 922 891. Well, first today, South Australia's worst grain road will be getting an upgrade. A section of road between Culpara and Arthurton was voted as the worst grain road in the state in a Grain Producers SA survey. Now, under the Australian Government's Road Safety Program, South Australia is going to get $168 million for upgrades to roads in the York, Eyre and Fleurieu peninsulas, as well as in the Mid-North and the Murraylands. And the CEO of Grain Producers SA, Brad Perry, says it's fantastic to see the funding come through, especially on the roads that are in dismal condition.
Yeah, this is massive news, Brooke, for grain producers, particularly on the York Peninsula and also regional communities, really. So, you know, we started the Worst Grain Road campaign looking to compile a list of roads that the grain producers put forward that we could advocate for on their behalf and really provide a targeted campaign. So, it's, you know, it's brilliant to have ministers and departments taking notice, listening and obviously delivering millions of dollars to our number one worst grain road.
Do you think that campaign might have helped push things along?
Oh, certainly. When we started the conversation with the department and ministers about Upper York Road from Upton Culpara and that 35-kilometre stretch, 36-kilometre stretch, you know, the discussion was around, well, there's a smaller number of heavy vehicles on that road at the moment, according to the counts they were doing. And what we needed to do was really provide evidence that grain producers and other users are avoiding the road because it's so unsafe. So what we will see now after the upgrades is we'll actually see grain producers will start using that road again. They've been avoiding it due to safety reasons, but certainly getting Minister for Regional Roads and the Minister for Primary Industries with the department in a grain truck out on that road to experience the condition of it firsthand, I think that made a really big difference. And I know that resonated with the ministers.
What were the biggest concerns that GPSA had with that road?
Oh, everything that they've actually funded as part of this lick of money, millions of dollars in being invested in it, all of the concerns appear to be addressed. The surface itself is terrible. It's cracking apart. The width of the road was quite bad. So it was a school bus route as well. So when truck drivers were carting grain along there, two of the wheels actually had to sit off the road on the dirt, so extremely dangerous. You know, there was hazards on the side of the road, no barriers and no tactile markings. So really, it was, in my view, it was possibly the worst road in South Australia. And as I said many times to ministers and others that, you know, we had better bike lanes in Adelaide in better condition than that road. And that was an indictment really on industry and the region. So fantastic to see that millions of dollars are being invested in this and we're getting up to a 3-star safety rating from the 1-star safety rating that it sits currently.
The Mallee Highway as well is looking to receive some funding too. That was also part of the worst grain roads list, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So that's a road that, you know, has been in very average condition for some time, and that was fourth on our list of worst grain roads. So certainly, we did a lot of advocacy on that as well, writing to federal ministers and state ministers, working with departments and also working with councils, local councils, on just highlighting those roads and making sure that they're being pushed up the list for priority upgrades. So, yeah, absolutely ecstatic too to see quite a good bit of money being invested in the Mallee Highway. I think the old catchphrase is that, you know, we could pour millions and millions of probably billions of dollars continually into roads. So it's good to see that we got a result on a few of our worst grain roads.
Have you spoken to farmers in the area? How are they feeling about this announcement?
Oh, yeah. No, they're absolutely ecstatic. So, you know, when I spoke to them originally at the start of the campaign, they'd been talking about trying to get upgrades for Upper York Road after Kapara for many years without any luck. So they shared some of the, you know, the horror stories and the concerns around safety, and they went in the campaign just thankful that there was a bit of extra spotlight on the road. So I'm not sure that they thought that we'd actually be able to get a result within 2 years. So speaking to them, yeah, they're absolutely stoked and, yeah, really welcoming the upgrade, not only from a safety point of view but also from an economic point of view. It means that grain trucks can use that stretch of road again now and not be going at a really low speed limit as they've had to, which is, you know, has really impacted productivity.
Brad, do you know much about the time frame of how long this work will take and what it will mean for being able to use that road?
Yeah, look, I've been speaking to the Minister's Office about this, and they tell me the work's actually expected to start in May this year, and it'll go for about a year. And just to show the extent of the work that's going to be done on that 35-kilometre stretch, I think they're estimating around 125 jobs will be created or used on that stretch of road for the upgrade. So, you know, I think that gives you a pretty good idea of just how much work is going to go on that Arthur and Kapara stretch. And even for there's a distillery along that road as well. So, you know, I think for all users of that road and all users of roads in regional South Australia, this is a huge win because departments are no longer just looking at solely traffic numbers. They're actually taking into consideration a lot of other aspects when looking at funding. And I think that's really critical going forward.
CEO of Grain Producers SA, Brad Perry. Minister for Regional Roads, Jeff Brock, says it's great to see funding for South Australian roads, particularly the one that was announced as the worst grain road in the state.
That sort of thing, the collaboration is very, very important. And one of the things we did, we had Country Cabinet down on the Copper Coast just recently and I had the opportunity as the Minister to actually travel that road. And I had been on that road previously over many years, but certainly I had the opportunity to actually get in a grain truck to experience it firsthand, to be able to understand what it's like for the heavier vehicles to go through there. But certainly there was a lot of lobbying and that was mentioned at the Country Cabinet. And this is the good thing about having Country Cabinets out there, because the people can actually talk to the Premier, all to the Ministers, and also the Premier and the Ministers actually experienced the locations firsthand. But certainly, it certainly did help, and the collaboration and the partnership between us all, communicating is one way to go. And as I say, I'm very, very very pleased to be able to actually do these upgrades. And look, the Kapara to Arthurton Road, that's going to be lane widening, shoulder sealing. We're going to have some shape correction, and that's to deliver a smoother surface. Also, audio tactile line marking and things like that. But also, we'll be able to, any safety barriers or anything like that will be removed, so that makes it a lot safer for that particular road. And the same with the Port Broughton to Bute Road. It'd be shoulder sealing, the audio tactile line marking and edge and so forth, and also the make certain that everything is a lot smoother there on that road there.
That must be promising for farmers to have this being looked at.
Yes, look, their input, not only the farmers there, but also Grain Producers SA, along with the member for Narunga, he's been ongoing support for this one here. He's helped secure the funding to deliver a safer and a more productive road in both of these areas, and which has been relied on by many of our regional communities. And as I said, it's not only the grain industry, and it's also about the increasing in tourism opportunities in that particular area.
That was the Minister for Regional Roads, Jeff Brock, speaking with Brooke Neindorf. And the Minister said the aim is to have those works completed by the middle of 2025. Right now, it's 14 minutes past 12. You're with Selena Green on the Country Hour today. Well, the culmination of dry years has led to one farmer getting out of cropping altogether. Grant Chapman farms 15 kilometres north of Oraru on the edge of cropping country in the mid to upper north. And now his operation has been focusing solely on sheep. Mr. Chapman says he's been closely following the recent challenges to the sheep market, but he remains optimistic that the fundamentals are there for the market to bounce back.
We've always cropped up until the end of 2022. We've had sheep and cattle all through our life, but cattle, probably we got out of cattle about 4 or 5 years ago when the cost of feeding them through the drought got too much. So we always intend to get back into cattle, but that hasn't happened yet. So virtually all I'm doing.
What was it that made you decide to change farming direction and move out of cropping?
We live in a pretty marginal cropping area here, and just the returns on our cropping in the last 20 years have been at break even, probably in a lot of those years and below. So the average over the long term is sort of, you know, we're doing a lot of work for not much return. So it was a decision made mainly on economics. We always had livestock, and at the time the decision was made, livestock were, you know, a better option, less risk, no upfront costs, like you do with the cropping, and you didn't have to hope you had a rain to make a crop. So the livestock were always a return on the livestock, so we decided to go that way.
The sheep market has experienced some of its own fluctuations in recent times. How are you feeling in terms of your confidence in the sheep market?
Well, it's certainly taken a fair dent just in the recent times, but I think the fundamentals are there for it to improve again. When we get a general rain sort of throughout, you know, South Australia mainly, because that's where we live, and I think the sheep price will improve. But in saying that, I think there's been a few issues for the oversupply, but whether the oversupply was just created by people sort of offloading stock before the expected dry period Bureau forecast, and also I think the live sheep issue with the government planning to close that down has created uncertainty in the market, and also has created a fair flow of sheep from West Australia through to South Australia, which has impacted South Australian prices.
If live export is banned nationwide, do you think that will have an impact on sheep prices?
I think it will to a degree. I think the government's dreaming if they think they can create more processing plants. I don't think it'll happen. It's controlled pretty much in South Australia by very few people. So I think it's just one of those things. I think it will impact. South Australia hadn't had live sheep for a good while, but it certainly was a good outlet for our stock when we did have it here, and it would be nice to see it reinstated, but I'm not real hopeful about that.
Just sort of finally, how has your summer been so far? How have you fared over the summer dry period?
Well, we had thunderstorms in January. We had a lot of rain. We had about 80 mils in January, so it was heavy and did a lot of damage to our fences and infrastructure. So, and it didn't grow a lot of feed. It just filled too quickly and didn't soak in. So it filled our dams, but it did create a bit of a feed gap for a while, you know, a feed buffer for a while, but that sort of, it's disappeared now with all this hot weather we've had the last 3 or 4 weeks. So it's... We've started feeding again, so it'd be another long process unless we get rain shortly.
That was Oraru farmer Grant Chapman speaking there with Kate Higgins.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, the importance of taking care of pastoral land is paramount to its longevity, and the next generation of graziers, well, they're getting right amongst it. A Rangelands Living Skin Field Day was held yesterday at a property in far west New South Wales, and a busload of South Australian pastoralists and researchers made the journey. It's all part of a week-long tour of select properties in the far west region. Sustainable agriculture facilitator with the SA Arid Landscape Board, Andrea Scherner, is part of the tour, and she spoke with Lily McCure about the trip and the importance of having young people take up an interest in regenerative farming.
We've come over with a group of, there's 18 of us, we've come over on a bus, and our bus participants come from a range of backgrounds and properties across the rangelands country of SA. We've got largely made up of pastoralists and graziers, and we've come over to share knowledge and learning with some of the project participants with the Rangelands Living Skin. So yeah, we're at Wyndham here today, and it's just been a fabulous day meeting pastoralists and researchers and learning a bit about their grazing management, but also how they're managing and protecting and regenerating their soils.
And that Rangeland Living Skin project, how is that sort of relevant to what you are all doing over your way?
It's very relevant because we operate in very similar climate and soil systems and really similar production systems too, beef cattle, meat, sheep and merino.
The participants that have been involved in today, what are their backgrounds, I guess, and how's it been for them?
So we've got a range of sort of next-gen pastoralists with us, so people who are at the start or the middle of their career working in the pastoral industry in South Australia. So if an opportunity like this is great for everyone's professional development. So these sorts of events give you great ideas and they link you up with people who might have more professional knowledge or data about certain ways of managing country, and it just helps us all to go home with an extra spring in our step to either try new things or to keep going with the way we're going with confidence.
Do you think that there is a growing space for young people in terms of rehabilitation of the landscapes and grazing management?
Absolutely. There's always room to improve any industry, in any industry. And I think that what we're seeing across the South Australian rangelands in particular is a real generational shift at the moment. Young people are coming into the industry, but also the next succession of families are taking more responsibility in a management space. And I think there's a lot of excitement to embrace new technology to improve land condition, but also to understand where we're moving with global markets, demand for cleaner, greener products, and also to consider the climatic shifts that are ahead of us. But I think it's a really, there's so many positive opportunities for young people to move into this industry. And we can see that here today by so many young people at this field day asking fabulous questions and really thinking about how they want to take their own businesses forward into the future.
Why is it important to have these young people in this space?
Without young people in any space, we don't have hope for the future. We have to engage everyone in our generational transect, and that's not to discount the value of wisdom of people who have been in the industry for a long time. That's the opposite. We need their knowledge, and we can only stand on the shoulders of the giants. But I think creating opportunities specifically for young people gives them confidence to ask questions that they might not ask when there's other people in their family that might be around, or even without feeling silly, like that they don't know those answers. So I think there's always space to really open and welcome opportunities for younger people to move into and give them confidence to learn.
Sustainable Agriculture Facilitator at the South Australian Arid Landscape Board, Andrea Scherner. Pastoralist Eliza Duro from Mount Victor Station, 72 kilometres northwest of Yunta, is one of those next-gen farmers on the tour who is excited about the opportunity to learn from others in the industry, passionate about restoring the land.
I have a really strong passion for like rehabilitation and like just helping the land be in a healthy state. So my manager is very supportive of that. And so he thought it would be a great opportunity and to see the country and see what other people are doing, hopefully be able to take something back.
What sort of inspired that passion for rehabilitation of the land?
So when I started at Mount Victor, it was at the end of the 2019 drought. I think it ended in like 2021 or something like that. So I seen the country at its very worst, and like I still thought it was beautiful and like thought it was great to be there, and then the drought broke and everything came back to life, and it was just amazing, like so much plant life, and just to see how well it bounced back and be like, I want to help protect this.
What do you think can be done in that space to help protect the landscape?
I think just educating people and making it enjoyable to protect it, like not making it a horrible job where you have to go pick up all the rubbish. It's got to be enjoyable, and you've got to have a passion for it, and you've got to be able to see ahead and be like, I want this to last for generations.
Do you think that there needs to be more young people in this space caring about rehabilitation?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it is getting a lot easier for younger people to come in and to like get really passionate about it, but that's the key. You got to love being out here, like where it's a bit out in the sticks, you know, like a bit rough. You definitely got to love it, and you got to develop a passion for it. But I think the older generation, the older people, they need to help them develop that passion and grow it, you know, and be like, and get them excited about it. It's like this land is so old and it's so beautiful, and it's so unique. It's amazing. And I think if you can get people looking at it at a different lens and to see what it can really do.
That is pastoralist from Mount Victor Station, Eliza Joro, there speaking with Lily McCure. You're with Selena Green. It's almost 25 minutes past 12. Let's head off to the Weather Bureau and say hello to Simon Timke. Hello, Simon.
Hi there, Selena.
I'm down in the lower southeast. Woke up to a couple of spots of rain this morning, but nothing really since.
No, but certainly cooler than it was down there yesterday, I reckon, isn't it? Now
absolutely.
That the southwesterlies have moved through, because it was pretty hot and humid down the southeast yesterday, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Very sticky. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've had a trough that moved across the west and south of the state slowly yesterday, and that's pushed right up into the far northeast. So still pretty hot and humid in the far northeast of the state, but over the remainder of the state, milder or cooler conditions in some parts with southwest to southeasterly winds pushing across. The other feature is a cold front that's pushing across the Bight at the moment, the eastern part of the Bight, which we're expecting to push across the sort of southern coastal parts of South Australia today. And that's going to cause the winds to freshen up a little bit further, still generally be southwest to southeasterly, but they will freshen up a little bit following the passage of that feature. And it will bring quite a bit of cloud. There's quite a bit of cloud over the south of the state. It's a little bit patchier over the north. And it might bring the odd shower or two as well. But I think we won't see too much on the ground out of it. If you pick up 1 or 2 millimetres out of it, I think that you will have done pretty well. And that's for the rest of Tuesday. And by Wednesday, most of that shower activity will have cleared away. I think just a slight risk of the odd shower, possibly a thunderstorm about the northeast pastoral district. Other than that, for Wednesday, conditions will be dry, I think, over most districts, with temperatures still on the slightly lower side, generally below average for this time of year over most parts. The winds tomorrow will persist from the south to southeast, and they will be fairly fresh, maybe even fresh to strong at times in some parts, and could see even a little bit of raised dust in the far northeast, I think, with some of those stronger winds tomorrow. And then through Thursday, Friday and the weekend, not a lot of change in the weather. Our weather is dominated by a high pressure ridge over waters to the south, which is going to maintain that general south to southeasterly airstream. We might get the odd light shower about southern coasts, but again, not much total expected out of it. A little bit of weather up in the far north developing over the weekend and continuing into early next week as we start to see a little bit of moisture pushed down from the north, sort of remnants of the tropical cyclone that's just moved across the Gulf of Carpentaria over the last 24 hours or so. So over the weekend and early next week, we start to see some of that moisture pushed down over the far north of the state. Which could produce some areas of rain over those parts as well, but not expecting it to push too far southwards where, apart from those isolated light showers near southern coast, conditions will be mostly dry. Rainfall totals for that four-day period out to the end of Saturday, generally not a lot in it, mostly less than 2 millimetres, but we could pick up the odd local fall of 2 to 5 millimetres. Things could be a little bit wetter over the weekend in the far north as we start to see some of those areas of rain develop. So we could see some falls of 2 to 10 millimetres possible in the far north. And in the far northeast, it looks like that might be a chance of picking up a little bit more with some of those heavier falls, maybe the odd spot picking up somewhere in the range of 10 to 30 millimetres in the far northeast. So it will be interesting to watch that area where we're seeing some waters come down from the Queensland floods earlier in the year, waters coming down the rivers heading towards Katatundi and Lake Eyre there. So a little bit more rain in the far northeast might sort of help those waters flow down that way as well, Selena.
Absolutely. Thank you, Simon. Simon Timke there. Simon Timke from the Weather Bureau. Now looking at the western inland parts of New South Wales, the upper western district tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high chance of showers in the southeast, medium chance elsewhere, and there's a chance of a thunderstorm. A little windy, southerly, 25 to 35 k's an hour. They're going to pick up to around 35 to 50 k's an hour throughout the morning and then turn southeasterly and drop a little bit back by the afternoon and evening. Overnight, between 16 and 23. In the day, between 24 and 33. For the Lower Western District, also partly cloudy. High chance of showers in the northeast in the morning. Chance of a thunderstorm in the morning and afternoon. And quite windy with those southeasterlies around 25 to 40 k's an hour again. Overnight, between 12 and 16. Daytime temperatures in the low to mid-20s.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Afternoon. What's the strangest thing you've eaten? Well, if you're someone who likes to be a little adventurous when it comes to dinner time, can I tempt you with a plate of snake meat? Python, to be specific. Turns out it's a good source of protein, and it is eaten more commonly in other parts of the world, but would you give it a go? Let me know. My talkback number is 1300 222 891 or the text line 0467 922 891. Maybe you already have. Let me know how you had your snake meat. We will talk more about snake meat in just a moment. And you ever had the dream of just hopping in a van, heading out into the great Australian outback all on your own? Apparently the number of women travelling solo around the country is on the up.
Everyone had a different story. We had an older lady that had lost her partner and they had planned to do quite a lot of travelling. And she just felt this desire to continue to do what they set out to do. So they weren't all coming from the city. They were coming from other country towns. They were travelling Australia, all of them.
That's also coming up in this next half an hour. First, though, let's cross to Matt Coleman for a news update. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, Energy Consumers Australia says that not all people will see flow-on savings from the draft ruling to bring down the ceiling price for annual energy bills. The Australian Energy Regulator has flagged a 2.5% cut, which will save average South Australian households $57 a year. Energy Consumers Australia Policy Director Jacqueline Crawshaw says prices will automatically drop for the small percentage of customers on the default market offer. The Urban Development Institute of Australia is predicting that the federal government will fall short of its goal to build 1.2 million homes by mid-2029. It believes the nation's housing supply will crash to its lowest level in over a decade by 2026 due to planning bottlenecks, labour shortages and soaring material costs. And the Trans-Australian Railway line remains closed due to flooding on the Nullarbor and is not expected to reopen until Sunday at the earliest. The vital east-west freight link was closed on the 10th of March after it was covered by floodwaters about 400 kilometres east of Kalgoorlie-Boulder. The Australian Rail Track Corporation says repairs are underway at multiple sites where water levels have receded. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with your headlines there. Well, you probably heard of snakes on a plane. What about snake on a plate? Would you ever give eating snake meat a go? It's not common here, but in parts of Asia, eating python snake meat apparently is a regular occurrence. And a new Australian-based study has found it to be a highly efficient source of protein. Research scientist with Macquarie University and co-author of this study, Dr. Dan Nantush, says the Burmese python snakes were able to go from a hatchling to a 3-metre, 15-kilogram snake in just 1 year, eating minced meat sausages.
We didn't set out when beginning the study to look at food security or python growth rates at all. We were actually studying the snakes for a completely different reason and just noticed serendipitously that our different diet treatments were resulting in these exceptionally fast growth rates. And when we started quantifying, you know, food inputs, because we were measuring every little bit of food by the gram, and when we started looking at what the food inputs were going in and actually what was coming out in terms of usable protein, we realised that, wow, this is a seriously efficient animal. And so we decided we need to study it further, and we did that.
So efficient how, and how does it compare to other proteins?
Yeah, basically they are more efficient than any other livestock animal studied to date. And the caveat is there may be things out there that are more efficient at converting food into usable protein. We just don't know about them yet. So it's top of the pops so far in terms of what has been studied, and that is essentially because warm-blooded animals or endotherms like us or mammals, birds, etc., they waste about 80 to 90% of the energy they get from their food in heat production because we're heating our bodies. Ectotherms or cold-blooded animals such as pythons don't have that constraint, so they're actually able to allocate far more of the energy they get from their food into things like growth.
So python farming, not something done in Australia currently. For those that don't know, what even is the process of farming pythons? How do you raise them?
Python farming has been fairly well established in parts of Asia where there's a sort of cultural predisposition towards eating snakes. We're talking primarily China, Vietnam, Laos, Thailand, countries like this. Essentially, snakes are bred in captivity and they live in relatively open cages. When I say open, mesh all around them. So they have access to the sun in these big warehouses that roofs can open up so that they can get direct access to UV light and things like this that they need. And then the way that the people in those countries interact with them ensures that they're incredibly docile. They just go to their cages, slowly pull them out, put them sort of on top of the cage, and then slowly feed them a sausage, and they're gluttonous by nature, and they just keep on eating. So there's no force feeding or anything like that, but they can, as you've seen, probably pythons eat prey items that are much larger than themselves, and so because of that ability, they can ingest a large amount of food in one sitting, and then they essentially sit there for a week digesting and growing like it's going out of style.
But another thing they can do is actually go quite a long time without food if that's necessary, right?
That's exactly right. And that's probably, you know, if we look at the food conversion ratios, salmon do a pretty good job. They're not as good at pythons, but the remarkable thing about pythons is just how long they can go without food. And several animals in our study were only 8 months old, and yet they'd gone 4 months of their lives, 50% of their lives, without eating anything and were continuing to grow. And that has real-world implications for the future, where we expect increasing drought under climate change, heat wave, climatic and economic volatility, supply chain breakdowns. And the real wonderful example is during COVID, when the supply chains pork fell over. Basically, no one was buying the pork that the pig farmers were producing. And so after 3 days, the pig farmers thought, oh, wow, we're losing a lot of money maintaining and feeding these pigs. And so they got euthanized.
And what's generally the time frame of raising these pythons? How old and big do they get before they're processed for meat?
Sure. So that the fastest animals in our study were able to go from essentially 90-gram hatchling to a 15-kilogram, 3.5 to 4 meter long snake in 1 year. So exceptional growth rates, exceptional fecundity. A big python can produce between 50 to 100 eggs and might live for 20 to 30 years reproducing in that way. So it can also have a huge number of offspring.
Right, so that really is turbo growth when compared to other livestock.
It is, but at the same time, the reason why it's remarkable is that those farmers are more or less dealing with the baseline product. You think about cattle and sheep, and these animals have not been genetically modified, but they have been selectively bred certain traits, many of which is rapid growth. Even just a modest increase through selective breeding of their already impressive capabilities would make them even more of a game changer.
Are you suggesting that this is just an industry that should be expanded worldwide, or is this something that could be brought to Australia, or should it just be an imported product?
It's received a lot of interest worldwide because people are beginning to understand this food security issue better, but we've been misquoted a lot, I must say. We're just the scientists who have done the work and are letting people know the message. We're just the messengers, if you will. We're not advocating for anything necessarily. Certainly we're not naive enough to think that Australians or people in the West are going to give up their chicken, their pork and their beef for something that most people are very scared of. We don't expect people to give it up at all, to be honest. But it's something that does need to be communicated, certainly for those parts of the world. Take Southern Africa, for example, where poverty and access to high-quality protein, the cognitive deficiencies that stem from it, etc. You know, you've all seen the UNICEF ad. Those are very real, and here you've got something that can withstand all the climatic, economic volatility and those challenges and still address that food security issue. It's in those contexts that we, if we were to advocate at all, that is where we would focus our effort.
So the study didn't consider taste for snakes, but is it something you yourself have tried? Have you tried python meat?
I have tried python meat.
What did you think?
Many different ways. I mean, I've said this to a few people. It's at risk of repeating a cliche, it tastes a lot like chicken. I guess it's somewhere between sort of calamari and chicken. It cooks a bit more rapidly than pork or chicken, a bit like fish, but has the same sort of texture as chicken does. And it's, to be perfectly fair, it's quite bland. You know, if you just fry up a chicken breast in oil in your pan, it tastes like nothing, right? And so it depends what you season it with, whether you're going to do a butter chicken curry or whether you're going to season it with something, and python is no different. It's a white meat, but compared to other things, you know, we've heard a lot recently about crickets and other potential sources of protein that are sustainable, and they certainly have their place, but obviously the legs and the crunchiness of chickens takes a lot to get one's head around, whereas a python, you're essentially eating the back straps of a large python. A butcher runs the knife down the back, and if the snake is 4 meters long, then they pull off a 4 meter long, thick, juicy piece of steak that can just be cut up into whatever portion you like. And I've had it barbecued, I've had it satay skewers on the barbecue, in marinade. I've had it in curries.
What's the most common way that it's eaten?
Good question. I'm not sure I could faithfully answer that. I mean, there's a lot of snake soup in Southeast Asia and China. Python is often sort of done as satay or barbecued and often in curries. So I've had it traditionally in curries in most places, I think. But it's a very lean meat, so not a lot of fat. All the fat bodies are retained separate sort of globules throughout the body. It's not actually marbled throughout the meat like a cattle beast. And so very, very low in fat. So it's the sort of, it's a bit like venison or kangaroo, where they can be tough and are succulent because of it. And so in that sense, it's good to sort of slow cook into a curry where it absorbs the flavour as well, because it's naturally not a gamey meat. It doesn't taste of much at all.
Tastes like chicken, apparently. I don't know how I feel about the idea of snake soup. Yeah, I'd give anything a go. Once, how about you? That is research scientist Dr. Dan Nantush. He was speaking there to Elsie Adamo. And you can read about this right now on the ABC Rural website. In fact, there is a great video included in that article that Elsie's put together. You can see the farm and see the conditions that the snakes are kept in. So hop on the abc.net.au/rural. One text that's just come through, this person had an opportunity to eat lizard. Excellent. Most like chicken or fish. So this snake sounds excellent as well. So someone who'd be keen to give it a go. How about you? I don't know. Yeah, I said anything you go once, see if it does taste like chicken.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're with Selena Green today, and it is 18 minutes to one. Well, you're choosing food at the supermarket. How much do you think about things like carbon reduction or net zero? If they don't really have any influence over what you're buying, you're hardly alone. So new research from public relations company Porta Novelli has found that 80% of Australians say carbon reduction and net zero have little to no influence on their food choices. Instead, it's rising hip pocket pressures that are making consumers more budget conscious when it comes to food choices. Considerations like being Australian made, animal welfare and fair pay for farmers are still important though. Porta Novelli Chief Executive Rhys Ryan says food marketing based on net zero isn't cutting through to consumers.
I think it's really talking about when you're standing in the supermarket aisle, is a brand's or a food producer's progress towards net zero top of mind? Is it influencing the way that you're purchasing food? And I think Australians are extremely pragmatic and probably a little bit skeptical. And so they're sort of very hard to understand abstract notions like progress towards net zero really aren't sort of spurring people to take practical action when it comes to choosing maybe one food product over another. I think that's really where it's coming from. Whereas sort of much more local, tangible, specific actions that food producers are taking can really resonate with people in a much more effective way, and that might actually cause them to choose one brand over another.
Okay, so given that most people don't worry too much about those considerations when it comes to their food choices, why is there this marketer or marketing fixation in some quarters on those considerations?
Well, I think it's a tough environment because ESG initiatives are sort of an inevitability. You know, there is rising expectations from activist groups, from governments, from institutional capital, and it's been a positive for the agricultural industry probably overall, that as these sorts of different ESG initiatives come through, we've seen some real improvements to the way that we produce food. But all those initiatives have a cost. And I think when it comes to food brands, they're trying to recoup some of that cost through extra volume, you know, in the supermarket aisle. And so I think sometimes that leads to some perhaps not so effective ESG-based communications, you know, on food packaging or in advertising. And I think, you know, sometimes it's really about the way we communicate it, not necessarily what it is. So to give you an example, I think, you know, telling people we're going towards net zero, I don't think that necessarily resonates. But if you can talk to people about a local effort you're making to maybe put a huge behind the meter solar plant on your food processing plant that's going to really lower your impact on our environment, I think people can see, oh, okay, that's a practical thing you're doing. It's going to save money. It's going to save electricity. It's going to help our environment. And hopefully it might even make my food products cheaper in the supermarket aisle. That all those things are a sort of a win-win-win for consumers, producers, and brands. So I think it's more about showing people practical action and not talking in sort of lofty, airy, abstract taglines that people can't really get their heads around.
And at the moment, of course, with high interest rates and really strong cost of living pressures, is it just the case that the hip pocket has to win out for a lot of people?
100%. I think that, you know, we sort of say in our report that 13 interest rate rises will harden Australians' hearts. But I think it's probably, you know, it's not so much hardening their hearts. It's just a practicality. It's a reality for people when they're buying food. But I do think that when it comes to spending in the supermarket aisle, Australians are interested in notions of fairness and interested in practical, tangible things.
And the other things that the consumers are telling you they do care about, those things like Australian made, fair pay for farmers, looking after animals, those things ranked relatively highly?
Yeah, so they were the top three factors influencing Australians in their purchase decisions: animal welfare, Australian made, and fair pay for farmers. And when you think about Australia, all those things are associated with notions of fairness. And I really do think that Australians are ultimately really interested in fairness.
The report also highlights some contradictions when it comes to food choices. For example, of course, that widespread rejection of caged chickens, but people not being concerned about what might be relatively equivalent farmed fish. Well, why are there those contradictions?
I think there's two things when it comes to caged chicken versus farmed fish. One is, I was really surprised, but when you think about it, you know, the activism against caged eggs has been now, goes back to the 1960s. I think that farmed fish is an issue that is very locally specific. So for most Australians, it's just not front and centre for them.
So overall, Rhys, the marketers who come up with these messages to sell these products based on various things, whether it's net zero or whatever else, do you think they're actually tuned into what the everyday consumer cares about?
Well, I think that one of the things that we should be clear on is that Australians are not one monolithic group. They're very different in terms of different age cohorts and where people live, city, country, that sort of thing. I do worry sometimes that people who are doing the marketing for food brands are mostly living in the middle of very large cities, and they're surrounded by other people who live in the middle of very large cities, and they see a lot of the activism that happens in the middle of very large cities, and perhaps the way their marketing is maybe falling on deaf ears in other parts of the country. So I think that might be one thing to consider. But also, I think ESG is really a commitment that businesses make to be more responsible as a business. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be able to use it as marketing. And I think that's where there's a bit of a breakdown there as well. Making sure you're operating responsibly is something you do to make sure that you're not a laggard. It doesn't necessarily mean you're a leader.
And are there inconsistencies in the level of scrutiny on particular parts of agriculture? So the report talks about, for example, the fixation on methane from cows and the relative lack of scrutiny on the massive water use in producing almonds?
Yeah, I think what we found is that certainly from what we know as communicators who work as specialists in agriculture, what we assume people know is not necessarily the case. So the fact that, you know, it takes a lot of water to produce an almond, for example, is probably something that people don't necessarily know. I think people would see the almond as the most sustainable, you know, product in the supermarket, and that's probably up for debate. And so I think that we can't assume a level of knowledge about agricultural products. I think we have to educate and keep communicating to people about how these products are made, where they're made, and what efforts their producers are making to farm them more responsibly. And I think, you know, there was a study I'm sure you're aware of that going back about 10 years that something like a third of all Australian school children thought that yogurt grew on trees. I think we have to assume that people don't necessarily know and start from scratch when we're communicating these things.
So just finally, Reece, returning to your earlier point, when it comes to the marketing and the selling of the food, should producers and food companies, should they just be focusing on those honest, real stories of food production rather than vague net zero platitudes, etc.?
Yes, I think that there is a great deal of scepticism about brands that come out with marketing that tells you we've got this all sewn up in a neat bow, we're on our way to net zero, and we've got it all sorted. I think that Australians respond much better, and all of our research shows that we respond much better to brands that are honest about where they are in their journey and what local, tangible, specific actions they're taking to be more responsible as a business and to produce their food in a more responsible way. And if that means that we are saying that perhaps our progress isn't as good as we'd like it right now, but we're going to be honest and transparent about it, Australians will give them a big tick. I like to say that progress is a proxy for achievement in Australia in when it comes to ESG. I think that if we can communicate our progress on real actions we're taking, then that to me is a much more powerful way to communicate how you're doing business more responsibly rather than talking in terms like net zero, which people don't actually really understand.
That was Reece Ryan there, Chief Executive of Porto Novelli Australia, and he was speaking to Angus Verley. 9 minutes to one with Selena Green. Ever considered decking out a van and hitting the road to explore Australia? It's a trend that is increasingly popular, particularly females going solo. Greta Gerkovich is one of those travellers who decided to seize the opportunity while she could. Lily McCua has the story.
For Greta Gerkovich, taking a gap year in her late 20s was an easy decision. After completing her studies in psychology, she decided that before entering her professional career, she wanted to explore more of Australia and enjoy the rare opportunity to take some time off.
So I know through placement and experience in the field that I am going to absolutely love the work, but I also know that once you start, it's difficult to stop. And once you get used to a wage, it's very difficult to give that up. Whereas being a student for, you know, 6 years, I was very used to living on a budget, and I knew that, yeah, this is probably a pretty rare opportunity to be able to take a solid chunk of time off. And while I didn't really have anything tying me down, I thought, you know, it's time to, yeah, make a move, and I haven't looked back.
Why Australia? Why were you so keen to explore what we have here?
We are so unbelievably lucky in Australia with the environment that we have, and East Coast is pretty populated. Like, there's a lot of beautiful places here, but I think on the west and the south and up north, there's so many places that are so untouched and just pristine, and our beaches are the best in the world, hands down.
While some may shy away from the thought of tripping independently, for Greta, she had no hesitation travelling solo and quickly discovered that many others were looking for a similar experience.
I mean, I'm pretty confident in myself, and I think there's a few different things that definitely help you feel safer on the road, but no, I really haven't had any bad experiences.
Were you expecting to see a lot of people like yourself, young female solo travellers, around Australia?
Honestly, the first time I did it, so I think it was 2018, 2019, there wasn't as many, I don't think, and 2023, there were a lot more girls on the road, which is awesome to see. And I remember in Esperance, I met a crew of 5 girls who were all travelling on their own, whether it be in vans, in troopies, or just in their car that they'd decked out with a tent, and they'd all met at different points in their travels and would come together wherever they could to have dinner and catch up and, yeah, convoy. Like, there was a lot of people that I met.
As to the appeal for females travelling solo, Greta says several factors have contributed to the influx in numbers, including accessibility and the rising expenses driving people away from more populated areas.
The cost is a lot less than the cost of living at the moment. If you don't have to pay rent, that is a huge reduction in the cost of living. And the sense of adventure, and I also think post-COVID, when everyone was restricted with their movements, the freedom to be able to go and do what you like is, yeah, very appealing.
Around the sort of safety aspect, do you think it's become safer to be a female solo traveller?
I think girls are getting more confident and getting better at trusting their gut. So I think it's a combination of things. And also, I think in the media, you often hear like the sensationalised stories. And obviously, there are things that go wrong and that's the reality of the situation. But more often than not, you don't hear about the great experiences people have or just the regular experiences people have where they go to a campsite, they camp and they leave the next day.
Keen to talk a little bit about your setup. What's that like? What did you travel in?
So I have travelled in vans over the course of my Australia adventures, and I built it out myself during COVID, which was a very big learning curve, and I made a lot of mistakes, but yeah, it was a learning experience, that's for sure. But yeah, my van, I think the approach to having the setup for me was just make it as simple and functional as possible.
The people you've met along the way, what's that like? Where have these people come from? I can imagine you've been meeting people from all over the world.
Yeah, honestly, so it varies a lot. I think when I got stuck in Western Australia, I actually was able to reach out to one of my friends who I knew was in the area that I'd actually met at a car park in Esperance. And she had met a couple of other friends up in Broome. They all kind of just joined up as this big convoy that we travelled across South Australia for 5 days together, which was unbelievable. But yeah, you can meet people in so many different ways. And as I said, like a lot of the free campsites, people are doing the same thing. And it can be as simple as asking about someone's setup or like, oh, like what sort of van have you got? Like, how are you running your different appliances? Do you have a fan? Like, how are you coping with the flies? That kind of thing. Like, it's as simple as starting a conversation.
In particular, the solo aspect, would you recommend that to other people?
Oh, absolutely. I've learned so much about myself and I'm so much more confident and capable and adaptable because you learn to rely on yourself. When you've been in positions where you're stuck literally on the side of the road with no way to kind of get out of a situation, then transfer that across to being in a regular job, I guess, and if something goes wrong, it's like, oh, this is nothing.
That was solo traveller Greta Gurkovich from Ballarat, Victoria. A station stay in the far west of New South Wales has also noticed the rise in solo female travellers passing through. Mount Gipps station stay owner Samantha Maiden says the number of solo females coming through the area has been evident, and they all had different reasons behind their journeys.
We generally get quite a broad mix of the general traveller and, you know, the grey nomads and the families, and then groups of different people that come through. But what we did see last year, which is quite new, was single females travelling by themselves, solo travellers, travelling all over Australia, which is great to see.
Why do you reckon there was that sort of increase in female solo travellers?
I don't know whether or not these are people that would normally travel overseas and they sort of still wanted to travel but, you know, get amongst their own country, I guess. A bit of girl power. I sort of had a joke with all of the ladies and said, you know, how do you feel about travelling solo? And, you know, they're also, you know, they're very cautious about their safety and different things, and they like to have a planned trip probably rather than just bob up on somebody's doorstep and hope there's a spot. They seem to be very, right, well, I know where I'm going next and how long it's going to take me. So they're quite sensible travellers. It was really noticeable last year, this real splurge of solo female travellers.
At Mount Gipps, station stay owner Samantha Maiden was speaking there to Lily McCure. Hello to Phil from Yankalilla, who's given a thumbs up to an Aussie spin on eating snake, python pie. You reckon it might be all right? John's curious where in the supermarket snake meat would go, red meat or the chicken section. Well, I guess white meat, so I'd go with the chicken and pork, I'd assume. John, who knows? It is 2 minutes to one. Nikolai Bellhartz will be with you for afternoons today. Hello, Nick.
I reckon I'd probably eat snake.
I'd give anything a go once.
I bet you it tastes like chicken. You know, inevitably.
Apparently tastes like chicken. Everything tastes like chicken.
Yeah. Just tastes a little bit like chicken. But if it's a sustainable way to produce protein and all that kind of, I mean, the growth rates and all that kind of stuff sound pretty incredible. So it'd be interesting. Maybe just as long as it's, you know how you can get salmon with the skin on or the skin off?
Oh.
I'd probably want my snake with the
skin off.
Scales off, please.
Oh, I just, that just put a shiver down my spine.
Sorry. Right around lunchtime too, I know.
Yeah.
How rude.
What have you got for us today?
Moving on quickly. The interest rate decision will be announced this afternoon. Nearly everybody seems to be saying that it will be a hold. That's pretty widely expected. But some people are starting to say maybe the next one might be a cut rather than an addition. So we'll try and get a bit of insight into that, because now they're doing these press conferences after that give you a bit more of a heads up. And we'll also be talking about lawns, the state of your lawn at the moment, given the odd weather that we've had. Mine's in precarious situation, so we'll try and see if we can write that as well.
You're not alone. Mine looks like a desert.
I know.
I don't have to mow it, though. That's the good news. Nikolai Valhartz will be with you this afternoon. Thanks for your company. It's 1 o'clock.
To get started with the ABC Listen app, find the App Store on your phone. Search for ABC Listen, tap the pink ABC Listen icon, and download it. Congratulations. Now you've got ABC Radio in your pocket.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.